Hi, everybody. My name is Joel Weinberger. I'm from the University of California, Berkeley, and we're presenting cross-origin JavaScript capability leaks, detection, exploitation, and defense. This is joint work with Adam Barth and Don Song, also of the University of California, Berkeley. So let's start by just talking about some pretty simple concepts about JavaScript and how it actually works in the web browser. So here's a common page that many of you have probably been to, ESPN.com. And we have a lot of different things going on this page, and we have a lot of different ideas going on, and one of these ideas is a JavaScript context. And what we mean by that are basically JavaScript from different sources. So in some sense, we're talking about the same origin policy here. So we have, you know, two different tabs here. We also have an ad on the ESPN.com page. And every one of these things comes from a different source, in particular different frames or different tabs. And so we have the first tab in the green up there, that's one JavaScript context. We have the main ESPN page itself, it's another JavaScript context. And then we have the ad on the page, which comes from yet another context, or rather is another context, and is a frame. Now, the question we sort of are asking in this research is, you know, is there any way for one of these contexts to sort of maliciously get an object from another context? So, for example, is there a way for that ad to get the cookie object of the ESPN.com page, even though it's placed in its own separate frame and its own separate context, and it's from a completely different origin? So, in this research, we have several contributions. We identify a new class of vulnerabilities, which are the cross-origin JavaScript leaks, which are a way for objects to be stolen from one context to another. We also develop a dynamic tool, which helps us to detect these bugs, and in turn helps us to analyze exactly what's happening with them. We also discover several real vulnerabilities, both within a web browser and also within a JavaScript application, or actually a JavaScript library, that supposedly provides a safe communication framework between contexts. And lastly, we propose a new enforcement mechanism for browsers to solve this problem and to prevent it in the future from occurring. And note that we are not promoting a new set of policies. We like the policies that are in web browsers these days. We just believe that the enforcement mechanisms for these policies are not sufficient. And so we propose a new enforcement mechanism to actually protect ourselves from these bugs and problems in the future. So in this talk, we're going to just give a quick overview. We're going to first discuss the current JavaScript security model. We're then going to discuss the new type of vulnerability that we have discovered in web browsers. We're then going to go into the actual our actual detection algorithm and mechanism. And finally, we'll discuss the actual defense mechanism that we're proposing. So let's start off with the actual current model that we're dealing with. So all of you are probably familiar with the DOM, which is the document object model in JavaScript. And basically, this is the mechanism that allows JavaScript code to manipulate web pages in a variety of ways. So for example, the DOM allows JavaScript code to, on the fly, grab some HTML node and change its contents. It also allows you to do things like grab the cookie of a page and other things like that. So the DOM has a particular enforcement mechanism. And specifically, if there's some JavaScript context, and in this case we just mean a JavaScript, some JavaScript code running, if it tries to access a particular DOM object, it goes through a reference monitor, and it says, you know, I'd like to access this object. The reference monitor, as you would expect, asks whether that should be allowed. If it is, and access is granted, then the JavaScript context is returned a reference to the object, and it now holds a reference to the object. Not surprisingly, if access is denied, simply nothing is returned, and nothing really changes. Basically how you'd expect. So something to note, though, is that the DOM is actually rather separate from the JavaScript engine. Now, there certainly are a lot of connections between the two, and they're highly related. But in fact, the JavaScript engine has its own model of what's going on in the world, which relates to the previous slide, where I showed that the reference is returned to the object. Specifically, in the JavaScript engine, it just basically deals with capabilities. And in fact, JavaScript engine itself basically says that if you hold a reference to an object, you are granted permission to access that object. And if you don't hold a reference to the object, sure enough, you can't access the reference. We're just simply saying there's basically no way through the JavaScript engine to sort of divine access to objects. Not too surprising, really. So just a quick recap here. We have two different models of what's going on in the JavaScript engine, or rather, in the web browser. There's the DOM, which provides an access control layer with a reference monitor that decides whether certain contexts should be allowed to access certain objects. For example, the document object, which is a very important object. At the same time, there's also the JavaScript engine, which separately has a capability system going on and says that if you hold a reference to an object, you have permission to access that object. And similarly, if you don't have access to an object, you are not able to access that object. So you might think this is a little weird, right? We have, within the web browser, two very different security models going on. And indeed, that sort of is going to be the source of the problem that we're going to be talking about. So let's actually start discussing what these vulnerabilities actually are, these cross-origin JavaScript capability leaks. So first, let's talk on a high level about some of the things that go on as well in the JavaScript or in the web browser. Specifically, we have different contexts, in this case, window 1 and window 2. And it turns out that the contexts are sort of defined by a very special object called the global object, which in turn, it turns out, is the reference monitor from the DOM that we were discussing earlier. And so you may have a lot of things coming off this web page, such as, you know, window 1 has function foo, window 2 has function bar. Both have their own document objects, which are totally separate. And clearly, there's something going on. So we actually want to say it's OK for function bar to access the global object of window 1. Now, the reason for this is that there are actually some special things on that window which other contexts should be allowed to access. So for example, a window is allowed to check the location of a frame on the page, right? Or you can also, and similarly, a frame on a page can check the location of the top-level frame as well. So that's sort of why we have the global object. And in fact, function bar should be totally allowed to access the global object of another context, the other context. However, it shouldn't be allowed to access arbitrary objects that come off of that object, right? And in fact, that's sort of like we said before, what the global object does. It serves as a reference monitor, which sort of prevents that. So this is, in a sense, not really an issue. We also don't want, you know, say bar, let's say there's a bug in the web browser, right? Not that it ever happens, but, and let's say bar gets a reference to foo. We also want to say, well, you know, bar really shouldn't have access to foo, right? Well, that turns out to be a little bit more of an issue. So what happens when the DOM security policy with a reference monitor actually comes and meets the JavaScript engine security policy, which are, you know, two very, very different things? Well, let's say JavaScript context 1 actually gets, you know, is granted access to some object and gets that reference to the object. Well, as we said before, there's no reason that the JavaScript context can't just pass that reference across to the other JavaScript context. According to the JavaScript engine, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. Additionally, and when I say passed, I of course don't mean necessarily willfully passed, but somehow is, you know, asked for that reference and somehow gets a hold of this reference. And then according to the policy we discussed before, the JavaScript context would then have a reference to this special object, completely bypassing the reference monitor. And that's actually what the cross-origin JavaScript capability leak is. Of course, some of the question comes in as to how this actually would occur. Clearly, if a context willingly gives some special object to the other context, that's not really anything too special. But the question is, can this be sort of forced upon them? So I want to just go back for a second here. The basic question is, we have a JavaScript context which goes through the reference monitor, grabs an object, and holds a reference to it. Somehow, that reference is then passed across to the other JavaScript context. And what we end up with is this other JavaScript context holding a reference to some object, perhaps sensitive, completely bypassing the reference monitor. All right? So the question is, can this actually happen? Can we ever come across this? And that's sort of what the next question in what we did in our research was, is how can we help ourselves in detecting these problems? How can we work on finding them? So the basic question here is we have some context. And if you remember, we defined the context by the global object that is associated with a set of objects. All right. So we have two objects, totally different contexts, and we want to basically ever know, does one of these objects ever reference another object from that totally separate context? So the first thing we had to do was we instrumented a web browser, specifically the JavaScript engine. In particular, we worked with the WebKit engine as it is open source, and we were familiar with it already. So specifically, we had to go into the JavaScript engine's object system in order to do the instrumentation. So of note, we did not instrument the JIT compiler or the byte code interpreter or anything like that. We were just simply working with the actual implementation of objects within WebKit. Specifically, we had to instrument the points of creation of objects, destruction of objects, and also references between objects. So when some new property is created on an object that points to another object. Whenever those events occur, we would simply make a call into our analysis library to sort of alert the library that such an event has happened. And the result is we get a great image of what the heap actually looks like at any given point. So what we actually are doing is we're working on doing a heap graph analysis and actually being able to get an image of what the heap looks like. And to start off with, we actually got a lot of really interesting graphs. So this is an example of such a graph. In fact, this is the most basic graph you can get. This is the graph of the empty web page, that is to say, the web page that has no JavaScript run on it. And you can see that already there's a lot of different objects going on. It's already relatively complex. You can actually reason about this, and if we were to zoom in on it, you can see all sorts of things you'd be familiar with. You'd see little lines that say document, you'd see other ones that say toString, and things like that. And you can see all sorts of interesting convergences. So this was actually a great starting point for what we wanted to do, because we could actually start seeing how these different objects are related to each other. You can see, though, that this is relatively complex, and not surprisingly, if you go to something, even google.com, which is actually a relatively simple web page with not a whole lot of JavaScript on it, it can quickly get a lot more complex. And in fact, it quickly gets to the point that these are basically unanalyzable visually. So for any non-trivial web page, you're really not going to be able to look at this page and really get a good sense of what's going on and be able to sort of visually track what's going on. So specifically, on the empty page graph, we had 82 nodes, 170 edges, big but not unwieldy. Google.com, still actually quite reasonable. But then when you get to the Apple Store, and then forget about it with Gmail, these aren't even graphable by GraphViz, which is the software we're using. So it was clear that we weren't going to be able to use just a visual approach to sort of deal with these issues and sort of to figure out what was going on. So we actually wanted to sort of automate the process of computing JavaScript context and finding out what's actually going on in these situations. So it turns out that computing JavaScript, we could actually come up with an algorithm for how to compute a JavaScript context. So if you remember, like I said, the global object for any given context is basically what defines the context for a particular piece of code, or for a particular object. And every object does belong to a single context. So it turns out that besides the global object, there's also another unique identifier, which is the object prototype. Which in the weird world of JavaScript prototype inheritance, you can sort of think of the object prototype as the ultimate superclass, or as the superclass of all objects, sort of almost like the object in Java. And in fact, every global object has one unique object prototype assigned to it. And furthermore, every object either has a special property called __proto__, which points to the object prototype, or alternatively, the transitive closure of proto references leads back to the object prototype. Okay, so we could basically, as we're going along, because it's a transitive closure, we could say that any time an object was created, check the proto property, and if it points to the object prototype, you know what the JavaScript context is going to be. It is the JavaScript context associated with that object prototype. And if it's not, then we can inductively say that this new object should have the same context as the object that's pointed to by the proto-relationship. Okay? So this is it's pretty important in how this works, but basically you can always say for any given object at creation, there is some chain that leads back to an object prototype, and that's what defines the JavaScript context. And note that these contexts don't change over time. They are defined at creation. So how did we actually do our experiment? Well, you know, we have this dynamic tool which can tell us what these contexts are. And over time, as you're running it over a program, we then say if there's ever a reference created between two objects, which are between two different contexts, throw up a red flag. We know we have something of interest. Turns out that there are some things which are perfectly harmless, such as the location or history objects, and we whitelist those. But for everything else, we have a suspicious edge. And so what we actually did to generate tests for these was we used the WebKit test suite, which at the time we were using it was almost 10,000 tests. Most of those, it turns out, are really useless. They're for drawing and checking CSS and things like that. So we actually only really cared about the 143 security tests, which focused on using frames, iframes, and checking object communication, or checking communication between them, checking to see if objects could be passed between them, things like that, and making sort of doing sanity checks. And we used those tests and ran them, and while they were running, we also used our analysis tool over them to discover if there was anything that we under the hood that we didn't see that was going on. Of course, this is hardly an exhaustive test. There's an infinite number of ways you could try to mess with objects in between frames and try to get things to happen. But it turns out that this actually gave us a pretty good way to analyze and give a proof of concept that these vulnerabilities actually do exist. And so, in fact, we found a couple. And here's an example of one of them. This is sort of the reduced heap graph from the test. So we took out all of the sort of extraneous stuff going on. And you can see in the upper right, there's a global object of the victim, and then somehow in the left, there's the global object of the attacker, and there are somehow in the picture two location objects. And I should mention quickly, the black represents objects from one security context, and the white represents objects from the other security context, in particular the victim security context. So somehow in the victim security context, there are two location objects. And it turns out, in this particular vulnerability, what was happening was that there was a bug that if... So I mentioned before that you can access things like the location and history objects from another's context in order to check them and check the value. And it turns out that there was a bug in WebKit that if you... that the location object is lazily created and is not created until it is actually needed. And if the first time it's needed and created is during the run of code in a certain context, then it'll be instantiated with the proto pointer pointed to the object prototype of that running context. So instead of the attacker's location object being created with the object prototype of the attacker's global object, it was created with the object prototype pointing to the victim's global object. And this is really bad. And the reason it's really bad is that you can do something like, for example, you could modify the toString method on the location object and actually say that should do something malicious every time it's called. And then for any object that's created in the victim's context, the toString method, whenever it's called, will do the attacker's will. And there's all sorts of other variants in this that are really interesting and sort of fun to play with. So actually creating vulnerabilities out of these were sort of subtle, but you can almost always do it, and that was another part of the work. So in WebKit at the time, with these 143 tests, we were able to find two unique arbitrary code execution vulnerabilities, or arbitrary JavaScript code execution, I should say, one of which, in fact, was actually a regression, which is sort of a point we'll get to later with our defense mechanism. And we were also able to look at the cross-safe, cross-domain JSON request library, and we were able to find a host of major flaws in that make it, in fact, completely unsafe and basically exploitable from any point. So at this point, we're still going to start talking about the actual defense mechanism that we believe web browsers should adopt in order to prevent this. And I think it's particularly a particularly salient point is the fact that one of the vulnerabilities we found was actually a regression. I believe actually it was the location one, was actually a regression that we checked in an earlier version of WebKit, and it was there in a much lesser form, but it was actually got much worse over time. So basically, what we suggest is that we should have access control checks on every property access. And before you gasp, we'll get to why that's not such a bad idea in a second. But you know, obviously, we have function bar here. Let's say that has a reference to the document object on both its own context and also the document object of the other context. You know, as we're saying, it really shouldn't be able to access the properties of the document object in the first Windows context, right? So we're going to say that, let's say it somehow, you know, there's a bug in the browser that gives it a reference to this. The browser should still be smart enough to say that that's a bad thing. So it'll give the thumbs up to its own document object and simply give a thumbs down to the other document's context. So we went ahead and we actually implemented this in WebKit, and we actually added in the access control checks that to make this happen. And we have a prototype that is available. And it turns out that this is actually a very reasonable thing to do. Turns out that if you run the three sort of major industry benchmarks, at least how they were running at the time, Dromio is the Firefox benchmark, SunSpider is the WebKit benchmark, and V8 Suite is the Chrome benchmark, you actually get pretty darn good performance out of it, even with our access control checks. So what this graph is saying is just that it gives the percentage slowdown with access control checks over the same tests being run with no access control checks, with the error bars just being the error over the number of runs that we did. And you can find that, you know, in the Dromio one, we had basically almost only 0.5% overhead, and in the V8 suite, in the worst case, we had almost 2% overhead. Now, you know, that doesn't sound, I mean, that's pretty good, but, you know, it still is some overhead. The good news is that in the past year alone, WebKit has increased in performance by 300%, right? So that's just from basic improvements WebKit has done to improve their own performance and make it a better web browser. And, you know, from our view, if you're talking about that 300% increase, 2% begins to look a little bit paltry if you're going to be getting really great added security benefits. And it turns out that there is a key reason that this performance happens and that it wouldn't have been so effective in the past. Particularly, it's the advent in WebKit, and the other web browsers are also implementing this, of something called the polymorphic inline cache. And we talk about this in more detail in the paper, but the basic idea is that for a given access at a particular line of code, or particular execution of code, I should say, in the JIT or bytecode, the JavaScript engine will actually do the access and will actually cache the result of the access. And the next time that comes across, that particular property access, instead of going through the hash table and doing the hash table lookup, there's a performance shortcut which says, we'll just go to an offset in memory and just grab that piece of information because we've already executed this line of code before. So what this means is that you, for the first time you access the property, you actually do have to go through the access control check. But because this particular line of code is already executed and these permissions will not be changing over time, for the future checks that go through, you actually don't have to do the access control check the next time you execute that same piece of code. So you don't actually have to do the access control check for every reference. It is implicitly done for you. And as you can see on the left, we have the performance with the inline cache, which is basically what we saw on the last screen. This is for a micro benchmark we developed. It's in the range of 1% overhead for reads and writes. But obviously, when you take away the inline cache, that performance goes through the performance hit goes through the roof, hitting almost 10%. Right. So this actually makes a real big difference. But it turns out that it actually can be quite decent to quite good performance. So in conclusion, we have developed a new tool using heap graph analysis to find a new class of vulnerabilities and to actually show these vulnerabilities in the WebKit engine, and also to use the tool to find problems within JavaScript applications themselves. We believe that web browsers should adopt a new mechanism to enforce the policies that they already want to enforce. So again, just to emphasize this, we aren't promoting a change in policy of any sort to web browsers. We like the policies that they have. We just think that the current enforcement mechanisms are insufficient. And finally, we actually are releasing our patches to WebKit open source at that URL. If they're not up right now, they should be within the next several hours, and they should be available for you to check out and use. So thank you very much, and do you have any questions?
Please use the microphones.
Ben Zorn, Microsoft Research. So the JavaScript benchmarks are going to have tight loops, and so your polymorphic inline cache is going to work very well, but in real code, real JavaScript, you're probably not going to see the same behavior. Have you measured that?
We've only measured it insofar as used applications and found that the performance was good. We have not done an official measure, as you say, which would be a very which is something we probably should go ahead and do. It was a little tough to set it up in the time that we had for an experiment of that nature, though. But you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I have a related question. So it strikes me that the benchmarks you've looked at basically don't use frames very much. So have you looked at mashup pages or Facebook or Gmail and things like that to measure the performance overhead of those?
So similar answer, which is that only through regular experience on those websites, you know, just sort of browsing the web through our modified browser. And we have not done any experiments on those particular web applications. And theoretically, it shouldn't really actually be any different whether there are frames or not, because the access control check happens for any property access. It doesn't matter if there are frames on the page or not, but the access control check will still happen.
I'd like you to clarify a little bit. At one point, you said that the attack was exploitable from any point, and I was wondering, does that mean that any page out there could trigger on any page out there? Does that mean that you need certain libraries to take advantage of this?
So for the WebKit exploits, for any page that an iframe was present on, the code in the iframe, or actually, I take it back, saying that totally incorrectly, it could be from either direction. So the answer is, for those particular vulnerabilities we found, they were exploitable from any particular web page. You don't need any particular libraries. Turns out some libraries make it significantly easier to develop an exploit for them. But for any web page could have been out on the web that could have just had, for example, an iframe to Gmail, and then if you visited that, you know, attacker.com with the iframe to Gmail, attacker.com could then grab the cookie for Gmail and own your Gmail. So for those particular ones, that they were absolutely exploitable from any web page. And they have been fixed in the latest version of Safari, we should mention. Should have mentioned that, sorry.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, we'll go ahead and thank the speaker.